KUSM San Francisco!
Generally don't think of Halloween as a psychedelic holiday. This year, we're going to definitely make it a psychedelic Halloween with our Sunday celebration here on Just Another Menace Sunday, the fact that Rocky Erickson of the 13th Floor Elevators is going to be appearing on October 30th and 31st at the Great American Music Hall. Yours truly, Dennis the Menace, NKUSF, co-presenting that show. And while we thought long and hard about trying to coax Rocky to join us in the studio, we realized that that might not be the best thing, because Rocky is fabulous on stage, but not as verbal. For those of you who saw the documentary that we showed at the Roxy a little while back, you're going to miss me, or perhaps you've rented the DVD. That's something that you would be aware of. However, thanks to our presenting the show, we have come to hang out with somebody who has not only history with Rocky, but history with Janis Joplin and Big Brother in the Holding Company and Boz Scaggs, and definitely can represent and has represented and will represent this amazing, amazing era in rock and roll. His name is Powell St. John, and he joined us here in Studio C here at KUSF just a couple of weeks ago for what was an amazing, amazing conversation. I learned so much, and you're going to learn so much. Played lots of music, and so we've managed to edit the interview down to one tight hour. Actually, we'll go over the hour just a little bit, but I think you are truly, truly going to enjoy this special celebration in honor of Rocky Erickson coming to the Great American Music Hall with Powell St. John. Hi there, it's Just Another Menace Sunday, your friend Dennis the Menace, hour number one, interviews with rock and rollers of note, hour number two, all new melodic rock and roll. And so here we go. Let's talk to Powell St. John. And by the way, his wife, Toby St. John, will also be joining us for appropriate moments in this conversation. So here we go. Let's go back to the psychedelic years of rock and roll with Powell and Toby on Just Another Menace Sunday. So we always start these the same way because this is indeed radio. And as much as we wanted to have the HD television crew in here, the makeup artist couldn't make it today. So we're just going to have to go with good old radio. So there's a gentleman I'm looking at behind the microphone. Would you identify yourself, please?
Well, I'm Powell St. John.
Let's start with Texas, because that's a good place to start, even though we're here in San Francisco. In the 60s, the infamous 60s, you were not, everybody thinks Austin, but there was a town before Austin.
Actually, there was really one town before Austin, but as far as actually learning things and becoming the person that I am, it was Austin that took me there. My hometown was Laredo, which is a sort of a unique experience. Not very many people are raised in a border town like that.
Population of Laredo, because it could have been Laredo, Mexico, couldn't it?
Well, there's Nuevo Laredo, Mexico.
Right.
Which is about 100,000 people when I lived there, and the Texas side was 60. I understand this Texas side is 220 now, and God knows what it is in Mexico.
Wow. So there was the imminent need as a young boy to get to the, quote, big city sometime fast.
Somewhere other than where I grew up, because I've got just a hint that there was a lot of things happening elsewhere, but sure weren't happening where I was.
And now back then in the 60s, were there, they were the still, I mean, Wolfman Jack came a little later, but not much. They were the big, illegal, 5 bazillion watt Mexico Top 40 radio stations cranking out that infamous sound that Jim Morrison and the Doors sang about, right?
Oh, yes. XEG, Monterrey, Mexico.
Right.
And all their programming was in English and aimed at the gringos.
And all the DJs were crossing the border to work there every day.
Right, because, well, I guess the power must have been a draw.
But in the 60s, you know, when you were growing up, it was right on that, and pun intended, border where rock and roll and everything was about to change in a major, major way. And of course, you can say that about any era. You can say that about Phil Spector. You can say that about the British Invasion.
Well, you know, I guess when I was 14, maybe, 1954, right around that time, this is when Elvis started coming up, and Carl Perkins on the radio from Louisiana, KWKH, and even WSM in Nashville. I used to cruise the radio dial late at night.
50,000 watts late at night, clear channel, that's right, exactly. Mm-hmm.
And you were just beginning to hear people like Jerry Lee Lewis and this sort of thing, and Little Richard. So the rock and roll revolution was just moving into high gear. And even though where I grew up was a peripheral backwater, we even got some of it. We didn't get all of it. We didn't get a lot of the Philadelphia stuff, the doo-wop. The community I fell in with, the artists and the poets and the literary people and the counterculture individuals, and some of them were actually politically inclined. although this was never the locus of interest for the people that I knew so much as the people that we knew. I was going to be a career officer in the Army when I went away to school. I wasn't thinking music at all until, I guess, maybe the first semester of my sophomore year, I met a guy, a roommate of mine, who was from Austin. He just didn't want to live at home, so he moved on campus. He was a member of the Unitarian Young People's Fellowship, and his little brother, who was in his last year of high school, was a guitarist and banjo player. So I got invited to the parties and so forth just because I was a friend of this guy. And I mentioned to little brother Lanny Wiggins, that I could play harmonica, but what can I do with it? I don't have an orchestra to back me up or anything. He says, I can play the guitar. And I said, well, what songs would I know? You know, I don't know any songs. He says, you ever heard The Ballad of Jesse James? And I said, well, sure, everybody knows that. He says, yeah, well, that's folk music, and let's play it. And that was what started me off.
Now, where did Kenny Threadgill come into the mix?
Well, we had been playing around the apartment building where I lived, and Lanny would come by and visit. And people came and went at this place. We nicknamed it the ghetto because of the association of marginalized people herded into one spot and kept there, you know, throwing a potato a day, metaphorically maybe. But he would come over and we would play. And I guess early in 1962, Janis Joplin appeared, came up from down in Port Arthur where she lived. She was a friend of some of the friends of mine that lived in the ghetto. So she came, and Janis had really done her homework as far as music went. She was into folk music, and she could sing pretty much, she could cop Bessie Smith just beautifully. And anybody else too, Rose Maddox, whoever you wanted. You want country stuff, she can sing that. And of course, Lanny and I realized right then, we got to get this girl to
sing.
We've
got
with
a
us.
Female vocalist yeah. to beat the band.
We got to get this girl to do it. And it wasn't hard. She was perfectly willing to be one of the boys, you know. So we became the Waller Creek Boys. Being one of the guys was something that might accrue status to a woman. Not that way anymore. But in those days, you know, the guys had all the power. If you were considered one of the guys, that gave you a little bit of clout, too, and legitimacy and so forth. And this was before the women's movement. But Janis, of course, would have needed something like that, because Janis was before the women's movement. And I think it could be said that she sparked a lot of interest in there being a women's movement, actually.
I didn't really know that much about the Waller Creek Boys, or really, you know, Janis prior to, you know, and I think probably about 72.5% of the audience, or probably much higher than that, has no idea that any of this existed.
I'm sure.
So when you kind of say to yourself, wait a minute, I literally was in the very first band that Janis Joplin was in. What comes to mind there?
Oh, I just think I'm tremendously lucky, that's all.
Pretty amazing. Now, you've got a CD there, and I think this is a great moment for us to stop yakking for a second, because I understand that there's a CD in your hands.
This is him playing harmonica.
Introduce yourself, Toby, by the way, because this is an egalitarian society here in Studio C at KUSF.
My name is Toby St. John, and I am married to Pal St. John and have been for 25 years.
I just wanted
to point out that he might forget to say that this is him playing harmonica.
That's because I was in the Waller Creek Boys, and that's who's playing this song.
Exactly. So what track do you want me to cue up here?
Try number two.
And tell me while I'm very, very gingerly queuing up the track and trying to be professional here and getting my volumes in order, tell me what we're about to hear.
Well, this is one called Railroad Bill. This is a folk song as far as I know. And this is one that the Waller Creek Boys worked up as part of our regular repertoire.
Well, let's listen to it, because I'm intrigued at the very least.
Railroad Bill, railroad Bill, he never worked.
Well, that definitely ended fast, didn't it? There you go. And that's the beauty of archival music, isn't it?
Well, you know, this thing was made on one of the first generation home recorders, one microphone, and done in a bar with who knows, 50 or 60 people around, probably. So it's amazing that there's any kind of anything on there at all, but it's a lot better than you might expect, even at that.
Pretty amazing stuff. And as I was saying off microphone, so to speak, the voice of the female vocalist,
right,
provided quite vocalist. Quite full throttle there.
Yes, indeed.
Now, did the Waller Creek Boys ever formally get recorded on a record label?
No.
Never did?
No, I don't think we ever even got paid for anything. Well, beer. Yeah. We got that.
You and Janice, the connection stayed very, very strong to a point to the fact that when Toby initially contacted me and said, well, okay, if you don't know anything about Powell, let me just hit you with this first. He was the writer of the first track on the first album that we're all looking at here by Big Brother and the Holding Company. And so you say Janice left. Janice left too.
Well, let me go back a little bit, because when I first met Janice, she had just returned from San Francisco. This was about 1962.
Right.
She had gone out there early on as, she said, they called her their little jive chick from Texas. She was on Grant Street with with what was left of the Beatniks by this time. And she'd just come back from there, which is one reason that she was so fascinating to me, because she knew the patois, the jargon. And I quizzed her at great length about what this meant, what that meant. And
what was going on outside of that immediate field of vision that you had there in Texas.
That's right. That's right. I knew there were things going on in San Francisco. And
wild and crazy things.
Stuff, yeah. Bongos and...
Yeah. And beatniks and insane
little,
people, yes.
Beards and berets and the whole bit.
Right.
So that's when I met Janice, and that's one reason that we became friends apart from the music. I think I would have gravitated to her anyway. Besides, she was pretty hot, you know. She was only 19, I guess. And... So, you know.
That had to come up somewhere in the conversation.
Well,
if it didn't, there would have been an issue here, I suppose.
I guess so. I mean, it was certainly an important part of Janice's
persona. I mean, she did have a great voice, but, you know.
So, that was when we got together, the Waller Creek Boys, and she was in school there for, I guess, around a year or so. But then she decided to go back to San Francisco, and she did. Around, I guess it was 64, somewhere in there. I'm not clear on these dates, I mean, for obvious reasons.
Right.
But it was somewhere in that particular, around that year. And she came back to San Francisco. This time she had a dismal, horrible experience. Meanwhile, I was working with Mr. Threadgill in Austin and doing okay. Eventually, Janice came back from the West Coast, a changed person, very subdued. I'm not sure what happened. She wouldn't talk about it. I didn't press the issue, but something had convinced her that she had to change her life dramatically. And boy, did she. Very conservative, dark blue business suits.
From San Francisco.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
That's wild. That's so anti... You know, kind of counter the culture.
Sure, and that's what she was doing. She was trying to divorce herself from that, and she got herself engaged to a guy in her hometown. And she was going to be married, and that was going to be it.
Obviously, that didn't last very long.
It didn't work.
Yeah.
And I think, and I never heard any of the details of why it didn't work or anything.
This is
like
not
that.
A detail that I think anybody will find in her bio.
No, I don't know what happened, but anyway, about... I guess maybe 6 or 8 months after I saw her in the dark suits and so forth, she came back to Austin. And she was playing guitar. She never did play a lot of guitar, but she played enough to be very effective behind her booming Bessie Smith voice. And she did some appearances in Austin with the guitar and singing blues. And she appeared at the 11th Door, was one of the venues where she was. And she was still in the dark blue suit when she was appearing that way. And but she told me that she wanted to go back to the coast again. And I said, Janice, you sure you can handle this? And, yeah, I know I'm going to be cool this time. And so she left again. Now, by this time, it was about 1965, and I was thinking about going that direction myself. I wanted to see what happened with Janice and whether she self-destructed or what. But I began to hear that she was with a band and that she was working and that she was staying away from drugs. Well, I don't know if that was the truth, but she was working and
achieving. Even that early on?
Yeah.
So she was married, but the ability to drink people under the table and do various and sundry other things associated with that, was that an early trait?
Oh, well, and from the first time I ever knew Janice, she was into that kind of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
She used to go with the guys over to Louisiana to the bars over there because you could buy liquor. And she began to have success. I'd heard that she was playing at Chet Helms' Avalon Ballroom and doing the venues, and she was getting good press and so forth. People would come back from having visited the West Coast and say, Janice is sounding great. This is wonderful. They got such great bands out there with such weird names like the Quicksilver Messenger Service and the Peanut Butter Conspiracy and so forth. And it just really sounded very attractive to me. And it seemed as though Janice was going to triumph this time. And that's when I decided that I really didn't want to do a thesis. I didn't want a master's degree in anthropology. It was a crock. I decided
rock and roll took over.
Rock and roll seemed to be the way to go, you know, and sex, drugs, and rock and roll. And it was all happening in San Francisco. I'd written this song for a girlfriend of mine who had left UT and gone to the University of Wisconsin, and it's called Bye Bye Baby. And Janice heard me singing it. She says, I like that song, man. Give me the lyrics. And so I wrote her out the lyrics, and she left for the West Coast with me.
And she did, but she didn't have a chart or didn't have the notes or anything.
She had heard the tune, and she knew how to sing it.
Maybe seeing you around. When I change my living standard and I move uptown. Bye bye, baby, bye bye. So long now, honey, so long. Yes, and if I do, okay, I'm gonna see you in the funny papers some old day. Bye-bye, baby, bye-bye. I get the feeling I could court you clean on in the fall. Wind up staying put off, foot down, strained out and stalled. I ain't got time to wait on you or to catch your Super Bowl. I got lots of things I gotta do. Bye, bye, my baby, bye-bye. Yes, I might do all right somehow. Oh, but you may not be with me, girl, when I do. Cause you're not with me now. Bye, bye, my baby, bye-bye. Oh, it's too bad you had to drift away. I could use some company here on this road. On the road I'm on today. Oh, Thought you might have been my wife, but you just settled for a place in my heart. You don't want a place in my life. I know that you've got things to do and places to be. Guess I'll have to find the thing in place for me. Might wind up out on the street or sleeping beneath a tree. Still, you always said that I should go. So long now, honey, so long. Well, I guess you know you're on your own. Seems you just got lost somewhere out on the world and left me here to face it all alone. You left me here to face it all alone.
I don't know. I think we should have left the microphone on for all the conversation that was going on during the music. So tell me about the version of Bye Bye Baby in the album, and then we'll get back into history for a few minutes.
You're speaking of the one that I did.
I'm speaking of Right Track Now.
Right. Well, this was an incredible story, you know. I, through the 13th Floor Elevators Association, I was contacted by a guy in Austin who has an Elevators cover band, who does very credible imitations of the 13th Floor Elevators and is very involved in their music and therefore knew about me. So he called me up and said he's coming to the West Coast. He'd like to come and videotape me and just talk to me and so forth, and he did. And then a few months later, he contacted me again. He says, let's do a CD. And we were thinking something very, very modest, you know, just acoustic guitar and harmonica, maybe something like that. But the next thing I know, he has contacted a guy that I met out here on the coast who lived in Bolinas in the 70s and early 80s. This fellow, George Gershwin, had come into a fortune on the death of his mother. And he had always been a Powell St. John fan, and so the fellow with the cover band, Fred Mitchum, called me up and said, I've got this guy, George, who wants to do a CD, and he wants to pay for the whole thing. He says he wants a CD of Powell St. John that he can listen to in his living room. And I said, okay, just get me a ticket to Austin and we'll do it.
You're there.
And in a week's time, we cut the basic tracks on that,
wow,
that LP with some exceptional musicians that that were hired for the sessions.
Rocky is on this record.
That's right.
And you know, Rocky, and this is timed very well, is coming to the Great American Music Hall on the 30th and the 31st, and there is a documentary, you know, that recently came out that a lot of my listeners saw, you know, when we presented it at the Roxy. We decided to show it on the big screen before it went to DVD, which was really kind of neat. Now, so, and Janis Joplin fits into this mix too, because, you know, the bio goes that she was very influenced by Rocky's singing style. So can you put that big pile of potatoes and mash them for me so it makes some sense? Because I have to say that I'm not sure that I understand all the connections here, because it's all so, you know, there's all these terms for it, but it's definitely a pretty weird, funky mix here. So help me, please.
Well, it is, you know.
Sort out history, because Janis was influenced, but you wrote the song, but, you know, it's like, whoa.
Well, Janis's being influenced by the Elevators was something that escaped me at the time. I don't know that I was even aware of it at all. And I heard about it years later. Clementine Hall, who was absolutely there at the time, verifies that she and that she was actually considering joining the 13th Floor Elevators at one time. And that's why she was singing there and why she was there. But I can easily understand that she could have been influenced by Rocky Erickson, certainly.
Well, you can hear it in the singing style, certainly on certain,
right,
you know, you hear on Pieces of My Heart, for example, and that's a Rocky scream all the way.
That, see, was the time that Janis was planning to go to the West Coast, and she was going to change her style. She was going to be in rock and roll. She knew she would be, and she was exploring a rock format to see how that would fit and what she could do. And sure, she took away some of Rocky with her. Now, how do I put this? Along about 1965, when the Elevators were an idea in Tommy Hall's mind, Tommy Hall was a friend of mine, and he was influenced by Timothy Leary and Alpert. Their Turn On, Tune In, Drop Out, LSD.
The first official publicity for the concept of being psychedelic.
Exactly. And so Tommy decided that he wanted to popularize these notions. And his genius was that he wanted to do it with a rock and roll band. This would get the younger people. And I thought at the time, yeah, it'll get the younger people and all the cops in Texas. We heard that they went down to the coast. He and his wife, Clementine, went down to the Gulf Coast to look for a band that was down there in Port Aransas doing Beach Boys cover tunes, and that they were a solid band. How they found these people, I'm not really sure. But they went down and met them and decided that they would make a good rhythm section to put behind this kid in Austin that they had found, Rocky Erickson. So they brought the guys up to Austin. The band was called the Lingsmen at that time, and put them together with Rocky. And of course, Rocky being Rocky, it was an instant meld. And we would hear that they're going to call themselves the 13th Floor Elevators, and they're rehearsing, and they're going to have their debut at the Jade Room on such and such a date. And so that night, the night of the debut, everybody in the community was there. And, you know, about half of us just preparing to see them all make embarrass themselves. And the other half thinking something really good would happen. And that half was the half that prevailed. He was like Janis. And I mean, Janis, there's a quote from Janis once where she said, "I just tried singing one time and I found out I could do it." Yeah, and Rocky was the same kind of thing. He had just had, he had an intuitive grasp of how to sing like James Brown, for instance, and Wilson Pickett, and you know, he listened to a lot of people, but he was just able to hear it and do it.
So you were there as an observer of all of this.
Mm-hmm.
What's on the turntable right now? Tell me how that occurred.
Well, you know, I was influenced in the same way Tommy Hall was. And I had some experiences there with drugs that gave me some ideas and changed what I was writing. I'd been writing before that, writing country songs and so forth. But it changed what I was writing. It changed the way I wrote, and certainly it changed the topics of what I was writing about. And Tommy heard it, and it fit what he was, what he wanted the band to say. So he grabbed some of these songs. I think the one that's on there now is Monkey Island, I believe.
It's Kingdom of Heaven.
Okay, that's, well, the song speaks for itself. It uses religious imagery to convey...
To describe an experience.
An experience.
So to speak.
Yes. And actually, it's an experience of two people.
I think what was said in a very lengthy way during the few minutes, 3 minutes of that song, was that the Elevators lived up to the psychedelic atmosphere that they created, and they did indeed coin the term psychedelic rock. They, way before the Summer of Love and the Airplane and all these bands that we talked about, the band found its way to San Francisco in many ways. It was still a Texas-based band,
But they did spend quite a bit of time here.
They did.
Cultivating psychedelic rock.
They were here when I arrived in December of 1966.
Right.
Now, I didn't see them but once or twice during the whole time that they were here. And I don't even know why that was. I think they were very busy. They had some bad times. They got their equipment stolen and some stuff. And my understanding is that the record label eventually demanded that they come back to Texas and cut another record. So they didn't make that many appearances out here. They did a number, but they were pulled away. And the consensus is that they were pulled away just before they would have become one of the biggest bands on the West Coast. Maybe they were pulled back because the Houston outfit felt that they would lose them to some major label if they were out there in the limelight too much. I don't know for sure.
So is that why they are a legend and legendary at the same time, but not in terms of actual record sales? Do you firmly believe that they were more than equally talented as the Airplane and Quicksilver and all of these other bands that did stay here mm-hmm. and did find their way to L.A. or San Francisco? And the fact that they skedaddled back to Texas makes them what they are to this day, which is, you know, a memory that people cultivate when they want to remember this moment in time.
Well, you know, I think their influence was mainly among musicians.
Right.
I think a much higher percentage of musicians would know the story and know who Rocky was than most people. And I do think that had to do with the fact that they were on a Houston label and cornered in Texas. And then they began to have legal troubles, of course, in Texas. And ultimately, that is what corroded the band, I think.
So what I want to do, because I want to make sure that we have enough time to do everything we want to do, because we're also going to play a song or two live here, mm-hmm. is there's another band that that you and Tracy formed, and I've got something queued up. And so tell me a little bit about Mother Earth. I mean, legendary San Francisco band.
Mother Earth, when I first came to the West Coast, I was looking to form a band, but of course, I didn't know anybody at all. I knew a few people from Texas that were here, but they weren't musicians. But one of those people was a guy named Travis Rivers, who was running a newspaper on Haight Street at the time, a little sheet that they'd give out to the homeless kids to sell, sort of like they do the street sheet.
Right, right, an early precursor to that. Right.
And it was full of happenings in the community, so Travis had to know what was going on. And he was friends with some people from Chicago, one of which a guy named Ira Kamen, who played Hammond organ. He was out here, he wanted to form a band, so Travis got me together with Ira and said, you guys need a bass player and a drummer and maybe a guitarist. And Ira said, well, I know this girl from the University of Wisconsin, Tracy Nelson. She's in Berkeley, and she'd like to form a band. So we went over and got together with Tracy. And then here were three of us that wanted to form a band.
You have a knack for finding the female vocalist, don't you?
Ah, boy. Well, I don't know. I've got a couple of good ones in my time.
So shall we listen to a track?
Sure.
Okay, let's do it.
The Human Torch. He's flashing, burning, ever since he freed his yearning. Love a crystal from the interzone. Spider-Man, now where are you creeping? Can't I hear you more? From the peaks where I've been preaching, wondering if my thoughts are reaching to the city where I we'll be right back. City full of superheroes. I can sit alone and play like Nero, walking on my wireless telephone. And you know, I'd sleep much better if someone would only read my letter. But the mail train's taken it and gone. Hope the folks back home don't worry, 'cause the boy is really in a hurry. Cross the river on the stepping stones.
So because time was wasting a little bit, we kind of cheated and skirted history quite a bit and went from Mother Hips to Boz Scaggs there.
Now, I've known Boz for, well, ever since I came to San Francisco. He's a Texas boy, too, but I didn't meet him there. I met him out on the coast. But he had helped us in the studio with that record in Nashville, putting in some fills on some tunes of mine. And so I hit him up when I got back to the coast thinking maybe I could keep my chops together and maybe get some musicians interested in forming a band. But Boz let me sit in with his musicians and rehearse with him for a while. And one of the tunes I was doing was a tune called I'll Forever Sing the Blues is the name of it. In a few months when Boz's first record came out, I think it was titled Moments, there was my tune, the first cut on side B, done by Boz Scaggs in a way that I could never duplicate. Beautifully done, I think.
Well, let's have a little bit of songwriter's revenge. During Boz, we managed to get set up for an instant session, and if anybody actually believes that we did that, then they'll just fall for everything to come from here on in. So it's all yours.
All right. Well, this is a little song that I wrote. It's an instrumental. I wrote it for my wife. There are lyrics, but she gets embarrassed if I sing lyrics, so I just do it as an instrumental. It carries the same warmth. Let's go. This is called I Love the Way You Played the Piccolo, Sarah Jean. Like every adult
such thoughts went through my brain, leading me into doing things Pop said I'd go insane. I thought about her night and day, and sometimes in between. She soloed on the stars and stripes forever in my dreams. And I love the way you play the piccolo. I love the way you play the piccolo. I love the way you play the piccolo, Sarah Jean. Now there were rumors that I heard that made me moan and groan, how she boogied on the band bus all the way to San Antone, soloed with a coronet. They said she liked his hair, but I believe it had to be because he was first chair. And I love the way you played the piccolo. I love the way you played the piccolo. I love the way you played the piccolo, Sarah Jean. She went out with a sousaphone, that guy was such a pig. Rumor was the attraction was because his axe was big. But every rumor that I heard I just dismissed as lies. And ever she will always be perfection in my eyes. Yes, I love the way you played the piccolo. I love the way you played the piccolo. I love the way you played the piccolo, Sarah Jean.
That was pretty darn wonderful. So this is an official thank you for spending all this time with us.
My pleasure, and thank you for inviting us.
You're welcome. Wow. What an hour that was, huh? Do you think there was enough rock and roll history that Powell St. John had to share with us? What a great way to celebrate the fact that Rocky Erickson is coming to the Great American Music Hall on the 30th and the 31st. I'll be there for both nights. I suspect Powell will be hanging out. We know Rocky will be there. Who knows who else? Thank you so much to Powell St. John. And by the way, you can get Powell St. John's record called Right Track Now. You can go to powellstjohn.com, or I'm pretty sure you can get it on iTunes. Or email Buddha, B-U-D-D-H-A, at lmi.net. All ways to get Right Track Now, which does have Rocky playing on the record along with amazing, amazing musicians. And if you have any other questions, any thoughts, any input on my interview in session with Powell St. John, please email me, Dennis, D-E-N-N-I-S, at menaceattic.com. Was going to start to spell it in the middle there. menaceattic.com. Well, it's time for hour number two of Just Another Menace Sunday, all new melodic rock and roll. But first, let's do something good.
Do you know what hell is?
Homelessness in San Francisco and across the country is real and growing. The Coalition on Homelessness is a community organization committed to making tangible improvements in the lives of the homeless. Coalition goals combine short-term solutions with long-term strategies to change social and economic justice both locally and nationally. The Coalition on Homelessness welcomes your time, money, and interest, so please contact the Coalition on Homelessness at 346-3740 to find out more.
Well, I say it every week, pretty much. And yet, I'll say it again. I have a big, big stack of music in the studio to play for you, things that I have sifted through of the ridiculous amount of music that I get to listen to, things I think you'll like. We call it new melodic rock and roll, and let's get to it. So, Mr. Engineer, would you please be so kind as to hit CD number 2 right now?